MacCast, Sunday, October 21st, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, you know, this last week has been one of those unusual weeks where there's not a whole lot going on beyond a bunch of rumors and speculation about what's going to be happening this week. Coming up, Apple is expected to announce, finally, the iPad Mini. We got invitations, or I didn't get an invitation, but the media got invitations to that event, so that's going to be happening on Tuesday. We're going to get into discussions about that. Of course, we'll recap you on all of the rumors and speculation on what might be going on at that event, and it is going to be looking, or it looks like it's going to be more than just the iPad Mini, so some good rumors and announcements, some things to get excited about related to that. We also have a couple of other bits of Apple news to get into, including a recall on some hard drives, or not a recall, a replacement extension program on some hard drives related to certain model iMacs. So you're going to want to stay tuned and listen in for that. Of course, we also have a bunch of great feedback and comments and tips and tricks to get in to as well. So we'll dive right into it here in a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a second and thank one of our show sponsors, and that's Citrix with GoToMeeting. They have GoToMeeting now with HD Faces. Great product. You know, more and more these days, a lot of us are working remotely. We have access to the internet, but we may not all be in the same office, in the same city, or even in the same country very often. But you still have to get work done, right? You've got projects, you've got deadlines that you need to meet. And in order to make that happen, it really helps to be able to meet and collaborate and share documents and information and work in a way that it's like you're in the same room, just like you were sitting around a conference table. And that's where a tool like GoToMeeting with HD Faces come in. You can be seen, you can be heard, and you can collaborate together. As a matter of fact, I've used GoToMeeting for years in my own business. I use it to help train clients. I have clients all over the world, clients in New York and Australia. I'm in San Diego, and so it works really good for doing that sort of thing. And best of all, you really don't have to be that technical to hold a meeting or hold a call. And it's great for your clients because they can just literally click a link, or your colleagues, you can send them a link, an invite to a meeting. They just click on it and immediately they're brought into that meeting. And now GoToMeeting has support for mobile apps both on the Android and the iOS platform. And the HD Faces feature is supported on the iPad client. So you can literally meet from anywhere that you can get an internet connection. You can try it now free for 30 days. All you have to do is visit gotomeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and be sure to use the promo code MACCAST when you sign up. And GoToMeeting, you know, meeting is believing. Great product. Check it out. And a big thank you to Citrix for their support of the MACCAST. So as I was alluding to at the top of the episode, the iPad Mini event has been officially announced. The invites went out last week to journalists and pundits, and they're all flocking to San Jose this week for the event. It's going to be held at the San Jose, California Theater on Tuesday, October 23rd, starting at 10 a.m. Pacific time. The invite went out, just said, we've got a little more to show you, so alluding to the fact that it is going to be the smaller form factor iPad. There's also strong claims in a lot of the rumors that the event is going to really focus on books, and specifically textbooks and education, so we expect to hear a lot from Apple and their executives about trying to position this as really a media tablet and something targeted at the education market. As far as the specs are rounding out, the new models are predicted to have a 7.85-inch screen, so really a little bit larger than some of the other 7-inch tablets that are out on the market. In terms of resolution, it's expected to have the same resolution as the current iPad 2, 1024 by 768. It'll have the Lightning connector, also front and rear cameras, and be a really ultra-thin, very light design. Some rumors are saying it will probably have a reduced bezel, so not quite as wide as the bezel on the current generation iPads. That'll help keep the form factor smaller, even though it has the little bit larger 7.85-inch screen. As far as what the thing is going to be named, of course, you've been hearing the media refer to it as the iPad Mini. That may not end up being the actual name. There's a lot of speculation and discussion about, will it be iPad Mini? Will it be iPad Air, which I think is the name that John Gruber is preferring? 7-inch iPad has also been thrown out there. I think it's odd that no one's just bet on smaller new iPad. And I'm half joking there, but, you know, Apple came out with the third generation iPad, and it was just simply called the new iPad. So why not smaller new iPad? Who knows? We'll find out officially on Tuesday. The pricing also seems to be up to debate. You know, early on, it was originally believed that Apple would aggressively price this new iPad Mini against things like the Kindle Fire and the Google Nexus 7 tablet. There were rumors as low as $199 as a starting price point, but most sources seem to believe that it was going to fall somewhere in the $249, maybe $299 price range. That was until last week when we started seeing reports of price leaks, supposedly from some third-party retailers, and they seemed to indicate that the starting price would be around $329 US. That would be for a 16-gigabyte Wi-Fi-only model. One thought was that there was a lower-priced model, something in the $249 price range, that may have been an 8-gigabyte model, and Apple may have since abandoned the idea of starting out with that limited amount of storage. It's now believed that Apple will have 16-gigabyte, 32-gigabyte, and 64-gigabyte Wi-Fi-only models, along with matching 4G LTE models. And, you know, it seems to me, like, personally, I would have preferred to see them leave off the higher-end 64-gig model in that 7-inch form factor, keep the 8-gigabyte model, and aggressively price at the $249 price point. I think it still could happen, but really, the rumors this week seem to be hard set on that $329 starting price point. So, when you look at the models across the board, the pricing tends to shake out, like, $329, $429, and $529 for 16-gigabyte, 32-gigabyte, and 64-gigabyte models, respectively. When you add on the 4G LTE, it's expected that'll bump the price up another $129 per unit, so the base prices on those models coming in at $459, $559, and $659 US for the same 16-gigabyte, 32-gigabyte, and 64-gigabyte models, respectively. Predictions in terms of availability are that pre-orders will begin after the event on Friday, the 26th of October, with units beginning to ship around November 2nd. The launch is also expected to be multi-country, and we've heard rumors of at least the U.S. and U.K. being mentioned specifically, but no other countries. I would expect the typical ones we see in the EU, Germany, France, and so on, along with Canada. Very likely, at least in the initial launch. Maybe Apple will even go broader. They've gotten more aggressive in terms of trying to roll out new products to multi-countries, but that may be impacted by the fact that we've been hearing about supply constraints on some of the component parts, specifically the displays, which always seem to give Apple some troubles, along with the back panels, specifically on the black model, which are rumored to be the sort of same anodized finish that is on the iPhone 5, which also had reportedly some scratching issues. So we'll have to see what happens. At the event, it's also expected that Apple could finally have iTunes 11 ready to go, have it out and make its appearance. I'm sure we'll see a little bit more of it in the keynote. Apple promised it at the iPhone 5 event, saying that it would be here in October. So that timing absolutely makes sense. As far as some of the new features, No more sidebar in iTunes 11. It now has a little drop-down menu that gives you access to specific views. So you'll be in music view or movies, and it'll be right there. You're not going to have the sidebar to switch between those. It's kind of a full frame view or full panel view in the new interface. You'll also have expand and place views. You can think of these like iOS-style folders where when you select an album, it sort of slides open in the interface, and then you get all the album details and the tracks and things like that. There's also in-store recommendations in place in there, so it's looking like there's going to be more of a heavier marketing emphasis within iTunes, sort of pushing you to more purchases on the iTunes store. I'm not so sure how I feel about that. There's a completely redesigned mini player interface that has a couple of nice additional features, including a little next up list. So you can click on that in the mini player and see what's coming up in terms of the next track. When you're playing an album or if you're on shuffle, you're going to know what the next track coming up is, and you can actually influence and change that list. There's also a search box that allows you to search for music to add to your next up list right inside the mini player. So that's going to be a nice new addition. And of course, there's a new redesigned iTunes store. So some nice new features in iTunes 11. And it'd be great if that was available for download on Tuesday, but we'll have to wait and see on that. It's also expected that Apple will update the iBooks application and the iBooks store. The Next Web noticed that there was an iBook listing on the current site that seemed to have a book requiring iBooks 3. So that's sort of what led to the speculation that Apple may put out a new version of iBooks. If they do that, it's also expected there might be an update to the iBooks author application. And there are also rumors that iBooks may be making their way to the Apple TV. That one seemed a little bit odd to me. I'm not sure how a ebook reading experience would go on a big screen, but if Apple can pull it off, it may be in there as well. So definitely some additional announcements surrounding the iPad mini launch. And it's looking like the iPad mini launch might not be just about iTunes, iBooks, and the new iPad mini. iMore started reporting back in August, and they continue to believe that Apple may release an updated version of the new iPad, and they could do it on Tuesday. iMore has dubbed the new iPad on their website the iPad Mark II, which I love that name, so wanted to throw that in this report. And reportedly, it's going to be a minor update. They're thinking they may bump up the processor to an A6 class ARM V7-based processor, maybe Apple's A6 custom system on a chip design. Also, Apple might add LTE support for international markets, along with updating from the 30-pin connector to the newer Lightning connector. As far as pricing goes, it's expected to remain the same. It would be interesting for Apple to do an update to the iPad so close to the release of the last version of the iPad. It may upset some of their customers, but if you kind of think about the reasoning behind it, moving into the holiday season and Apple's desire to kind of standardize on the new Lightning connector, it could make sense for them to do sort of a small bump up on the iPad as well. We'll have to see if that one comes true. I'm kind of 50-50 on that rumor. I think Apple might just stick to that yearly release schedule, but iMore seems pretty convinced, and they have a pretty good track record with rumors. And despite the fact that the invite says we have a little more to show you, it might end up being a lot more based on the rumors we've been hearing this week, because it may not just be iPads, it may be Macs as well. We're getting reports that maybe a new iMac and possibly new MacBook Pros could be revealed at this event. The new iMac reportedly has a brand new design, a thinner profile, more of a teardrop shape where it's thin at the top and sort of rounded at the bottom. It's actually been 531 days since the last update of the iMacs, so it would make sense that Apple does an update. Whether or not it'll be part of the announcement or something that's sort of silently updated, it sounds like there's enough in here, though, that Apple may at least mention it at the event. There were some leaked images from a Chinese blog that claimed to show the new iMac. It does appear to still have the front chin, so there had been some speculation at one point that a new iMac design would sort of get rid of that and be almost all screen on the front. It's looking like that's not the case, at least with this update. The glass, though, is reportedly thinner and supposedly glued in, so not sort of separate components, completely glued in, just like in the Retina MacBook Pro. It's not certain at this point whether it will be a Retina screen or not, but general speculation is that Apple's not ready to bump that up. And, you know, the 21-inch and 27-inch sizes for a Retina display would be quite expensive, I think, to manufacture at this point. So it makes sense that maybe Apple's not going forward with that. Also, just producing those screens would be incredibly technically challenging. But it does seem that there's going to be a 21-inch and a 27-inch redesigned model, although some of the rumor and speculation is that the 21-inch model could hit before the 27-inch. So we'll have to see on that. They also believe that in order to make it thinner, it will lose the optical drive. I think that's no stretch of the imagination that Apple's been moving away from optical drives on all their models, and this will be the first time they remove it from the desktop units. At least one report believes that Apple will also finally start selling 8 GB RAM modules in their build-to-order configurations for the iMac. So to date, you could buy 8 GB modules, but not from Apple. You had to go through third parties. If they keep the 4 slots in the design, that means you could get up to 32 GB of RAM in the new iMacs, which is a nice jump up. It could be, though, that the thinner design requires that they have less slots, dropping down to 2, which would keep the RAM configurations with 8 GB modules the same at 16 GB. As far as when availability will be, it's believed late October to early November release, and pricing on the models is expected to stay the same as the current generation 21 and 27-inch iMacs. It's also believed that the 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro could finally make its appearance. I talked about this a little bit on the last episode, although I think I confused a bunch of people because I kept referring to it as the 13-inch Retina MacBook Air. I apologize for that. There is not, as far as I know, currently any plans to update the MacBook Air models with Retina displays, although I'm sure Apple's thinking about it. It's just not happening in anytime soon. At least we're not hearing anything about it in the rumor mills. Apple is expected to finally announce that 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, though, and the same source of the iMac leaks is saying that the design has been experiencing some thermal issues, which has caused a delay, which is why we've been hearing about the unit for so long, but haven't really seen Apple put one out yet. It is expected, just like the 15-inch model, to come in 2 different configurations. The display resolution is rumored to be 2560 by 1600 pixels, so falling into that Retina range. And according to leaks of at least 2 sources, at least one of the 2 variants will feature a 2.9 gigahertz Core i7-3520 processor, which is a nice bump up for the CPU. There were suspected images leaked this week as well that reportedly show the ports on the new unit. It shows 2 Thunderbolt ports, 2 USB, what I would assume to be USB 3 ports, an SD card reader, the MagSafe 2 connector, and also an HDMI port, just like on the 15-inch model. So a nice complement of ports on the 13-inch if that image does turn out to be accurate. And as far as pricing goes, prices are rumored to be starting at $1,699 US, which would put it about $500 above the current non-Retina 13-inch MacBook Pro. So definitely a price premium, but I think Apple can command it for the new Retina display. It's going to cause a lot of buzz, and I think there's going to be a lot of people clamoring for the new 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro. Not to be left out, there's also some speculation that there might be an update to the Mac Mini, and that is long overdue for an update as well. It's expected to have better processors, more RAM configurations, and more storage. I am also speculating, and this I haven't read this, but it's just my personal opinion, that Apple would possibly also update the USB ports to USB 3. I think that's something they're going to do across the board, and I would expect them also to drop the FireWire 800 port. The new Mac Mini is also reportedly getting the 8 GB build-to-order RAM module options, so you're going to be able to jam more RAM in there. And pricing is expected to remain the same at $599 and $799 for the two standard models. And also, Apple is expected to retain the $999 server model in the Mac Mini line. So new Macs coming soon as well. And so it's going to be definitely a big week for Apple announcements. So stay tuned. We'll have coverage next week on exactly what went down on Tuesday on a future episode of the MacCast. And I'm really not kidding about next week being a huge week for Apple announcements, because just a couple days after the iPad mini event, Apple will hold its Q3 2012 earnings call. That happens on October 25th. And Apple, no surprise to most of us, is expected to have remarkably good earnings. On the whole, for 2012, Apple is doing very well versus the PC industry. Apple's calendar year 2012 revenues are up 30% year over year, while the broader PC market has dropped about 4% this year. Apple is getting ready to post its September quarter numbers, and high-end predictions are that they will have sold about 27 million iPhones, 17 million iPads, 4.9 million Macs, and 5.7 million iPods, with revenue of $36.4 billion and $8.93 earnings per share. So as you can see, the iPhone is expected to be the big seller in the quarter. 27 million is on the high end of the prediction. The average number of units that analysts are predicting Apple to have sold in the third quarter is around 26.3 million. So strong sales, but actually slightly lower iPhone sales. Gene Munster is a little less bullish on iPhones. He believes that iPhone 5 sales will be strong, but may have resulted in an overall year-on-year decline of about 35% for non-iPhone sales. So that pulls the number down a bit. The net result would be 25 million iPhones sold, but for year-over-year iPhone sales, Apple may see an actual quarterly decline of about 4%. Still, for the fourth quarter, though, the end of the year, Munster is incredibly bullish. He expects really strong sales, predicting about 49 million units sold in the last quarter of the year, and total predicted revenues of about $56.1 billion for Apple. So just on iPhone sales alone, it looks like Apple's going to have a killer last quarter of the year. If they can produce enough of the iPad minis fast enough, the end of the year numbers could be completely off the charts. So Apple's going to have an incredible fourth quarter from all estimations. If you're the owner of a 21-inch or 27-inch iMac that was purchased between October 2009 and July 2011, and it has a 1 TB hard drive, you may want to head over to Apple's website or contact AppleCare and see if that hard drive isn't eligible for a replacement. Apple extended this week its hard drive replacement program for the Seagate 1 TB hard drives that were used in 21.5-inch and 27-inch iMacs sold between October 2009 and July 2011. If you have one of these models, there is a page on Apple's website that I'll have a link to in the show notes at maccast.com, where you can check your serial number to see if you have one of the affected units. You may also want to check your email, because Apple has been reportedly sending out emails to some customers who qualify for the hard drive replacement program, letting them know they should bring their units in. If you do have one of the affected models, what you should do is first immediately make sure that you back up your entire system. Use Carbon Copy Cloner, Super Duper, Time Machine, offsite backup like CrashPlan. I don't care how you do it. You should be doing it already, but for those of you who haven't done it, get it backed up immediately. You don't want to lose your data, and the Seagate drives in those models reportedly are having higher failure rates than they should, which is why Apple has extended this program. But do that, then get your Mac into an Apple retail store, to the Genius Bar, get it to an Apple authorized repair center, or contact Apple's technical support immediately to arrange getting a replacement drive. The program does cover affected iMacs for 3 years. after the first retail sale date or until April 12th of 2013, whichever provides you longer coverage. But you're not going to want to delay on this. You just want to go get in if you have an affected model and get it replaced. Apple's doing it for free, so there's no reason not to do it or to delay doing it just because you have longer coverage term. So don't wait. Get it done and get your data backed up and protected. Over this past week, Apple's new iPods finally hit the streets. The 7th generation iPod Nanos, the 5th generation iPod Touches, and the new iPod Shuffles started arriving in consumers' hands. Geekbench did some testing on the updated A5 processor that comes in the new iPod Touch, and it came in right where you might expect. It was just under the iPhone 4S in terms of performance, which also has an A5 chip running at 800 megahertz. That's a dual core chip with 512 megabytes of RAM, so exactly the same specifications that is reportedly in the new iPod Touch, and it's testing out exactly the same. iFixit did a teardown of the new iPod Nano and has some additional technical details. The battery looks to be double the battery life of the prior generation design, and that would make sense because they have a little bit more room in that taller package, even though it is quite a bit thinner. The design is also very tightly put together with, as you can imagine, no space and a lot of stuff glued in place. The battery, lightning connector, volume controls are all on the motherboard. That means that replacing individual parts is not really possible. You're going to have to kind of replace most things together, although they did note that the display and the LCD digitizer are separate components. So if you do happen to damage one of those could potentially be replaced separately. The 16 gigabytes of NAND flash does appear to be supplied by Toshiba. And the Bluetooth and FM radio features are supplied by a Broadcom chip in the new iPod Nano. And then finally for this week, it looks like Apple has been burning a hole in its pocket, at least with some of its cash hoard. They went on a bit of an acquiring spree this week, or at least we heard about a number of acquisitions that Apple recently made. And those acquisitions apparently are focused more on the hiring part of acquiring. Earlier this week, it was reported that Apple was acquiring a second company that was founded by Lala founder Bill Nguyen. This time around, it was Color Labs. They are a social video startup that has had so far lukewarm success. Actually, it's been reported that they were in a bit of trouble or are in a bit of trouble. The early belief was that Apple may be interested in acquiring some of the company's video-related patents and that the deal was a multi-million dollar deal for the purchase of the company. Later, All Things D reported that their sources claim the deal was not a complete buyout, but rather that Apple had acquired the company's engineering team for between $2 to $5 million. Color has been reportedly close to shutting down, and so the deal would seem to let Apple get the engineering talent while leaving behind the company's IP and name. I would assume they'd be shopping those to some other buyers. Of course, neither Apple nor Color are commenting on any of the acquisition rumors. Apple also reportedly acquired the HTML5 company Particle this week, or actually last month. Particle was at least partially backed by pop star Justin Timberlake. Once again, the news broke and All Things Digital, or All Things D, reported that it too was a partial acquisition of just some of Particle's talent, not the entire company itself. Particle has done work for Apple, Google, Disney, Motorola, Amazon, Yahoo, and Sony. Apple hasn't commented on this deal either, which reportedly did happen late last month. The assumption is that the talent acquired would be working on Apple's web-related technologies, things like Apple.com, iAds, iCloud.com, and possibly the new iTunes and redesigned app stores. So as you can see, Apple has been quite busy over the last couple months with the acquisitions and all the new products. And They are driving hard into the end of the year with expectations relatively high for their performance. But that's going to do it for the news for this week. But before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's Smile. You know, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen. I'm talking about those all the time. Great applications. They also have PDF Pen for the iPad. Well, they now have PDF Pen for your iPhone as well. That just came out. And now you can have PDF editing even in your pocket. With PDF Pen for iPhone, you can add text, images, and signatures to your PDFs. You can make corrections, resize and delete images, even fill out forms just like you would on the desktop application. It, of course, also has all those great annotation and commenting tools, making it perfect for providing quick feedback to colleagues while you're on the go. It has iCloud integration, which means your PDFs are truly portable. It allows you to seamlessly transition between your various platforms. So if you have PDF Pen for the Mac and for the iPad, you can quickly access all of your documents no matter where you are and no matter which device you happen to have handy and with you at any given moment. And best of all, right now, PDF Pen for iPhone is introductory priced at just $4.99 on the App Store, and it's already optimized and ready for your new iPhone 5's taller screen. So be sure you grab it now. Head to the App Store, look for PDF Pen for the iPhone. Also, check out PDF Pen for the iPad while you're there. And if you want to get more information and details on all of Smile's great products, including PDF Pen for your Mac along with Text Expander, you can get that over at smilesoftware.com. Check it all out, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So if you heard last week's episode, you probably heard that I had someone asking about printing a physical address book from the Contacts app. And specifically, this listener was looking for a replacement for AppleWorks. Now, I had offered a couple different suggestions. One of them was to maybe look into Bento, which is FileMaker's sort of, home level version of the FileMaker database application. Actually, pretty good replacement for the database functionality that you used to find in the AppleWorks product. Another idea I had was printing from address book directly, which does have the ability to print out an address book format, like a little list of addresses, although it has some pretty limited options in terms of what you can do with it. And so the best idea I could come up with was simply doing a mail merge using Pages. And I described how to do that in that episode. So if you missed it, you can go back and take a listen. But I got an email this week from Scott, who sent me a link to a really cool application that may also be worth checking out. It's called Address Book Reports from Scruffyware. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It's a $15 shareware application, and it looks like it's been around for a while. I think, as a matter of fact, when I was doing my research for last week, I even came across it. But when I was looking at the release notes and sort of when it had been updated, I thought I noticed that it hadn't been updated since January of 2006. But when I went back to look this time, I may have missed it before. It looks like there's a new beta version that was updated and recently added back in February. February 2012, they did an update and added universal binary support, because up until that point, it looks like it was only supported on PowerPC. So I decided to take another closer look at it. I downloaded it. I tested it on my Lion machine, so I cannot say if it works on Mountain Lion, but under Lion, it did a great job of printing a physical address book. It has all kinds of different options. You can select multiple columns. You can control the font and the size of the printout. You can add different section labels and have it break those sections at different points. It also has the ability to select which phone numbers, addresses you want included in the printed address book, as well as whether or not you want to include the email address or any notes, any things like that. So you can really kind of control what is actually going to get printed out. And it's not just for printing out a physical address book. It also supports printing out cards and envelopes, as well as labels. I didn't play around with any of those features, but just for the address book printing alone, if you need that feature, it's probably well worth the $15 shareware fee. So what it does is it actually generates a PDF, and then you can take that PDF, you can save it, or, of course, print it out. And I think that's going to give the functionality that a lot of you might be looking for. So definitely check that one out, Address Book Reports. And thanks, Scott, for sending that link in. And so now staying on the topic of contacts and address books, I actually received this question related to iOS 6 from Blake.
Hey, Adam, this is Blake Shores. And hey, I had a question. I am actually in the real estate industry. I'm actually live in Austin, Texas. And my main issue right now is when the iOS was just updated to iOS 6, I noticed that the contacts app in both my Mac and my iPhone has changed a little bit in regards to being able to add contacts to specific groups, mainly from my iOS device. Now I can see those groups, but I can't actually add specific contacts that going to those groups. And I was wondering if you had like a solution for me in terms of like another application that I could use or something along those lines. And thanks a lot for the podcast and all the info, man. I've really learned a lot from listening to you. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Blake. Yeah. I don't have another application that I personally use. I know there's a couple out there that people like, so I'd be curious to just ask you what you think. Do you have a recommendation for Blake? So if you do, send in your recommendations for maybe an alternate application that you can use for managing contacts on iOS 6, something specifically where you can add contacts to a specific group. But the thing that I think, Blake, you're alluding to is an issue that Apple has significantly changed how you view and interact with groups in the Contacts app in iOS 6. It changed significantly from iOS 5 to iOS 6. So before, you would have a group, and when you were on your device, you would navigate into that group. It sort of had a little arrow that you would click on. So when you went into the groups view, you'd sort of drill down into that group, and then you'd see a list of just the contacts in that group. And once inside that group, you could tap on the plus button to add a new contact. And when you did that, it would add that contact to the group. Now, the change that Apple made in iOS 6 is all of the groups are kind of merged into this single view. And now when you go into the groups area, you click on that groups button, what you get is a series of checkboxes to either toggle on or off the different groups that are active in the view. So you tap the groups button, like I was saying, and you get your various accounts. You'll see them listed there, things like your iCloud account. And within each one of those accounts, you have all the groups listed, and there's these little checkboxes next to each group of, you know, that shows whichever contacts are active and currently being displayed. Now, there is an all button where you can toggle all of the groups for your account, and you can also toggle, of course, individual groups by tapping the individual names and turning on or off those little check marks. And then right at the top, there's a hide show all button that actually toggles all of the check marks for all of the different accounts that you have set up in the Contacts app. So the way it works now, if you want to add a new contact to a specific group, what you need to do is set that view so that you're just viewing that one individual group. So to do that, you tap on the groups button in the contacts application, and then you'll want to tap the hide all contacts button, and then go in and tap the single group that you'd like to view, and then hit done. And then when you're back in the contacts application, you should be viewing and only seeing the contacts in that single group. And once you're in that one group, you can tap on the plus button, add a new contact, and then when you add that, it will add that to that one group that you're viewing. So the new process, as you can see, is a bit cumbersome, but you can achieve the same results that you had before. Interestingly, when I was playing around with this, if you have more than one group visible, but not the all group, adding a contact seems to add it to the group that's highest in the alphabetical order. So, you know, if you have a group called Adam's contacts and then a group called Test Contacts, and they're both active, and you add a person to that group that you're currently viewing, it's going to add it to the Adam's contact group. And of course, if you have all groups turned on and selected, then it doesn't assign it to any group at all, which is the thing that you were likely experiencing. Now, you know, one advantage of the new system over the old one, even though it is more cumbersome, is it does allow you to see specific groups sort of merged together, so you can mix and match them as you needed, as you need. I still think I prefer the old way, since it seemed to be much more intuitive than the new way of doing things. So I can completely understand how you were a bit confused on how you would go about doing this. I personally had to go in and figure it out based on you sending in my, you know, the email, and just thinking about there's got to be a way to do this. And that's how I stumbled upon it. So I hope that helps you out. But likely someone in our audience is going to be able to recommend a better application. And I'll try and follow up on that when I get responses on the next episode. Next up here, I have a question from Bill, and Bill's a musician, and he was emailing me to let me know that he uses iTunes and iTunes playlists to actually create and print out his band's set lists. But the trouble with doing that was that the default font size of the song list that you print out is in a 9-point font, and you really can't in any way change the size of that font or change the font itself to actually print it out any differently. So there's really no controls when using the print feature. And, you know, Bill's like me, he's getting older, and it can be a little bit difficult and tricky to kind of see smaller fonts. And specifically, part of the set list is sort of the key that the song is going to be in, and the C and the G with the font that Apple is using look really close to each other at that small of a font size. So what he was wondering was, is there a way to control or sort of hack or alter the way that the playlist prints out? And as I was reading through Bill's email, I realized that some of you might not even be aware that iTunes actually has some special print options for printing out different kinds of things related to your music. So what you can do is you can select a group of songs or an album or a playlist in iTunes and then go under the File Print menu, and you'll notice you have kind of these three choices. You can print out a CD jewel case insert, you can print out a song list, which is what Bill's doing, or you can print out an album list. And each one of these, you know, selecting each one of these radio buttons gives you some additional options for printing out each type of thing. And so in the case of like the jewel case, for example, you can print out text only, you can print out mosaics with the different album covers and all the tracks that you're happening to be printing out. So this was for like when you would burn a CD, if you wanted to print out a little jewel case insert to go inside with the CD, you can create a really pretty nice insert using just the built-in print functionality that's in iTunes. For the song lists, you can actually print out the songs, the user ratings, you can print out by play date, or you can print out using a custom list, which basically whatever columns you're currently viewing in iTunes, those are going to print out on the song list printout. And I'm assuming that's what you're doing, Bill. So getting back to your question about, you know, is there a way to adjust the font size, maybe some way to hack into it? That actually turns out to be the only way I could figure out to actually alter the font in the iTunes printout. So with that said, I'm going to give you the procedure for doing it. I don't recommend using it, though. I played around with it, and it seemed to work fine, but you are going to have to drill in and really hack the core of the iTunes application. I don't know how iTunes will respond. You could potentially end up breaking your iTunes. So at the very least, if you're going to get into this, make sure you have a full backup. Of course, you could always re-download and reinstall iTunes, but it might be more trouble than it's really worth. But regardless, here's the procedure. And I actually found the procedure, or at least parts of the procedure, and I based this whole thing on something I found over on a Mac Rumors forum thread. So I'll have a link to the original thread in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check it out. But basically, if you're going to do this, proceed at your own risk and just know that you're hacking, you're pretty much hacking iTunes. So to do it, if you have iTunes open, you're going to need to make sure that you quit it. And then you're going to want to go into the Finder, go into the Applications folder, locate iTunes, and then control or right click on the iTunes icon and choose the Show Package Contents option. That'll open up a new Finder window, and then in there you're going to want to navigate into the Contents folder, into the Resources folder, and locate a folder called English.lproj, L-P-R-O-J. Find that folder, and if you're doing this for another language, you're going to want to find the similar folder for whatever your language is. But select that folder, and the first thing you're going to need to do is change the permissions on that folder. So with it selected, go under the File menu in the Finder and choose Get Info. The shortcut for that is Command-I. And then in the Info dialog that comes up, find the Sharing and Permissions section. If it's not expanded, go ahead and open it up. And then you're going to need to click the little lock icon and enter your admin username and password. Once you've done that, you want to change the privileges for the Everyone group and make sure that everyone has read-write access to the folder. And once you've done that, you can go ahead and close the info window. So back in the Finder, back in the iTunes package contents, you are going to want to go into that English.lproj folder, and then you're going to want to locate a file called textstyles.plist. Locate that file, and once again, you're going to need to change the permissions on that file because we're going to go ahead and edit it at some point here. You want to select the textstyles.plist file, and then again, from the Finder menu, choose File, Get Info. In the Info dialog, expand the Sharing and Permissions section, click the lock icon, enter your admin username and password, and then change the privileges of the Everyone group once again to allow it to have read and write access to the file. Once you've done that, close the info window, and then you can go back, right-click on the textstyles.plist file, and choose the Open With option, and then go down to Other, and then in the Choose Application window, you're going to want to find and select the Text Edit application and go ahead and click Open. When it opens up inside Text Edit, what you should see is the contents of the plist file, which is actually just an XML file. So if you've ever seen XML before, it's going to look somewhat familiar. You're going to want to scroll down and you're going to want to find the element, the entry that has the key numbered 9100. And then under that, you'll see a tag that says string. And within the string, it's going to say printing body. And then under that, you're going to look for and change the number that sits between the integer tags. And by default, it's going to be set to 9, designating that that's a 9-point font. And you want to enter the desired font size that you want, for example, say 14 points, so change 9 to 14, and then go ahead and save the file. Again, you're going to need to be very specific about what you're editing. You really only want to change that number 9 to a number 14 or 18 or whatever point size you want that printout to be. Once you've done that, go ahead and save the file. And note that when you change this, the ownership and permissions on that text styles plist file is going to change to your current user account. And this is what could potentially cause unexpected issues with iTunes in the future. And it's the one part of this procedure that I worry about a little bit. But again, in my case, when I tested this, this seemed to work fine. iTunes seemed to work fine after I hacked this. So it seems relatively benign, but just be aware of that. So once you've done that, go ahead and quit Text Edit, and then go ahead and relaunch iTunes. And now when you go to print out the song list, it should be using the new larger font size. So that's how I was able to do it. I looked around and tried to find some sort of third-party application or some other way to print out a set list based on an iTunes playlist. I couldn't find anything else. So maybe the better way to go about this would be, again, to use some other application like Bento for entering in your set list and your song list and stuff like that. I know with Bento, you can put media files in there. So if you want to drag in the actual audio files, I think you could add them to your Bento database and you can put all that information in there and maybe better control sort of how you print that stuff out. Again, I didn't test that. It's just something I was thinking about in theory. You might try, but otherwise, that's how you go ahead and hack your iTunes. So good luck with that, Bill. And again, don't come to me if suddenly your iTunes stops working. You probably just want to trash it and reinstall it. You could, of course, go back to your backups, which I know you have, and restore iTunes from that as well, which would undo the sort of hacked edits that you would do using this procedure. But that's how you do it. And sticking here with iTunes for a minute, I have a question from Phil who wants to know about manually managing his media, and specifically with the new version of iOS 6 and iTunes.
Hi, Adam. My name is Phil Grayville. My question is regarding iTunes. I have just recently now changed my operating system to Mountain Lion. I waited for a while, and I just recently also just changed to iOS 6 on my iPhone 4. I did this within 2 or 3 days of each other, but just about a week ago. And the problem I'm having is I am old school and like to sync by hooking my phone up to by USB to my Mac, and I like to manage my music manually so that I can pick and choose exactly what artists, albums, or specific songs I want to use. It becomes helpful, especially for my young kids, where I want them to be able to hear certain songs, but I would rather them not hear other songs. So I do it song by song for my kids and sometimes for myself. But since I've updated, I still click the manually manage music and videos on the summary page when I hook my phone up. But when I go to the music and try to click and drag whole artists or albums or any specific songs, it no longer clicks and drags to the left-hand side column where my iPhone is on the side there. So I don't know how, other than go using a playlist and adding individual songs to a playlist, to just click and drag. And even for the videos and movies and TV shows, I can't click and drag the movies anymore one by one. I was wondering if you had a fix for this. Thanks, and really enjoy listening to the show. It's very informative and helpful. Have a good day, Adam.
Hey, thanks, Phil. You know, I went and looked into this. I'm actually kind of new school now when it comes to my iTunes, and I use iTunes Match, so it's really been a while since I've set up a device to be manually managed, but I used to, just like you, really prefer to use it that way. And so when I received your voicemail, I decided to go in and sort of reset things with my iPhone 5 and iTunes, and here's how it worked for me. So I went into iTunes, I selected my device from the device list on the left, I went to the summary tab, just like you mentioned in your voicemail, and I checked on the manually manage music and video option. And once I checked that on, I clicked the sync button. And then once it sort of synced up, I could expand the sections from my iPhone in the devices list on the left, and I could select any tracks that I wanted, and I could hit delete on them to remove those tracks from the iPhone. And I could also drag tracks from the music library and drop them onto my iPhone in the device list, and it would transfer those over, which is how it's supposed to work. So you were mentioning that that didn't seem to be working for you. I tested this on my iPhone 5. I think you mentioned that you had an iPhone 4 possibly. So I don't know if maybe it's a bug. I was also doing it on Lion and not Mountain Lion. So maybe it's a Mountain Lion bug. But it really should be working. One thing you might try is simply restoring your device and maybe even just toggling on and off that manually manage music option, but I'm guessing that you possibly tried that already. Now, if that doesn't work, there does seem to be a new kind of second way to manually manage music that I ran across, and I didn't realize this was going on. So before I went to the summary tab and clicked the manually manage music, what I had done was I had just turned off my iTunes match options. But at that point, when I docked my iPhone, it went back to the old method of syncing where it, under the music tab, I had the sync music option turned on, and then I had the option set to only sync selected playlists, albums, artists, and genres. And as I was flowing through that, I saw that you also, even with that turned on, have the ability to sort of manually manage things. So if you'd like to try this, what you can do is in iTunes, select your device from the device list on the left, then go to the music tab and make sure you have checked on the sync music option, and then make sure to set the option to selected playlists, albums, artists, and genres, and then don't check any playlists, albums, artists, or genres, which sounds weird because you just set that radio button, but instead scroll all the way to the bottom of that pane, and what you'll notice is there is a manually added songs section, and there's even a little note down there at the bottom that says add songs by dragging them from your library to your iPhone. And so if you go into your main music library and drag the song from the library onto your iPhone in the devices list, you should see it sync over to your device and then show up in that section at the bottom of the music pane down there. There's a little list and the tracks will start to fill in there. And then if you ever want to remove a song, what you can do is go into that same list on that panel and select the song, and you'll notice there's a little remove button. So you click that and it takes the song off. If you want to put a new song on, just simply drag it over to your device, just like you would if you had the manually manage music option turned on under the summary tab. But in this case, you don't have to have that checked. You just have the sync music option checked under the music panel. So that worked for me as well. Maybe that'll be a workaround for you if it does turn out to be some sort of bug related to your device or to Mountain Lion, but you might give that a try. But, you know, to try and dissuade you from being old school to maybe new school, I'm going to give a plug for iTunes Match. And I'm frankly surprised that I'm actually an advocate now for the iTunes Match feature, because I really at first I didn't think it had much of an appeal to me, but I wanted to try it out, so I paid the $25 for a year, and I have to say I really like the service, because now I don't have to worry about syncing anything, I don't have to worry about manually managing anything. I just turn on iTunes Match and I always have access to all of my music from any Mac or any device that I'm on, and I don't have to worry about any of the syncing stuff. Now, granted, on my iPhone I am grandfathered into my unlimited data plan, so I don't have to worry about, you know, downloading too much data over 3G or 4G. But even with not having that, iTunes and iTunes Match and the app on your iOS device does have the option to turn off downloading and streaming over cellular. So you could just enable it so that you pull down stuff over Wi-Fi and then have access to it once you are outside the Wi-Fi area. You can just, you know, literally click that button to download the stuff from iCloud so it gets loaded onto your device sort of on demand when you need it. So, you know, it's a great feature. You might consider looking into it. $25 a year, I think it's a steal in terms of the price. I think it's well worth the value. At least I've gotten the value out of it. So that's another option that you may want to check out or explore. And if you have run into this issue that Phil's been having and maybe have a fix, let us know about it. Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com, and I'll try and pass that information along. Shifting gears a little bit away from music and iTunes, let's talk a little bit about mail. I received an email from Richie who pointed out a little frustration he was having with mail, and it's actually one that I share with you, Richie. I've been frustrated by this problem for a while now, and it's related to the preview pane. I love having the preview pane in mail, and it sounds like you do as well, but the problem, as you pointed out in your email, with the preview pane is that if you select a message that message gets marked as red when the preview pane is open after, I think, a second or two, or almost immediately, it seems like. And there seems to be no way to control the time or the behavior of when that message gets marked as red. And the really annoying thing about this is when you're deleting or you're archiving messages, the selection automatically jumps down to the next message. And when it does that, if you have the preview pane open, it automatically marks that message as red, whether you wanted it to do that or not. So in my case, my workaround has always been to just collapse the preview pane and not use it at all. And some people don't even know or realize that you can actually collapse the preview pane in Mail, because starting, I think, in Lion and continuing in Mountain Lion, there's not a clear indicator that there's any way to actually close that. So what you do if you want to close the preview pane is actually just double-click the dividing area between the message list and the preview pane, and you'll notice it'll collapse. And once it's collapsed and sort of pushed over to the right-hand side, you'll notice there actually is a little handle that appears, and you can click that in the message viewer window, and you can grab it and drag it over to expand the preview pane back out, or just simply double click on it to have it reopen that preview pane. Now, what's cool about collapsing the preview pane is it does have the added benefit of not automatically alerting spam messages that get through your spam filters that you've opened and read those messages, you know, basically validating that the spammer has a valid email address. That's another side disadvantage of using the preview pane, is that once you've selected that message, it's going to send a signal back to wherever it came from, or can send a signal back to wherever it came from, that, hey, the person's opened the message and they've read it. So spammers rely on that feature as well. So Richie sent me the email because he found actually an even more elegant and better solution in the form of a third-party add-on for Mail that allows you to control the preview functionality, and it's called True Preview. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And it lets you control the specific behavior of when messages in the preview pane get marked as red. So you can have it like the default. You can have it set to immediately mark them as red when you click on that message in the message list, or you can set it to never, or you can specifically set it to mark it as red after a certain number of seconds, and that's controllable from the Mail add-on. So once you have it installed, what you'll do is you'll go into the Mail preferences, and you'll notice you have a True Preview option in the preferences, and you can control all this stuff. What's even better is you can also mark it red based on a number of event triggers, things like replying to the message, forwarding the message, viewing it in a separate window, or even scrolling in or clicking in the preview pane. So it won't actually mark it as red until you do one of those specific actions. Plus, you can set this up on a per account basis, so you can have different rules based on which account you're using. So you can have one account maybe trigger on replying to a message, and maybe you have another one where it's set to never mark it as red when you're viewing it in the preview pane. So that's really cool. And the application is donationware, so you can download it and use it. If you do, really consider contributing some money to the developer so that he continues to make great software like this, because this is a really cool little add-on for Mail. And I want to thank you, Richie, for sending it along, because I had not heard of it before. But it certainly takes some of the frustration out of Mail and using the preview pane, which, again, as I said at the beginning, is a really nice feature of Mail, but something that I really haven't been able to use because it doesn't function the way that I would like it to. And I think this helps out with that. And then finally for today, I want to share a comment that I received from Steve. And he's having his own kind of old school, new school dilemma related to his brand new iPhone 5.
Adam, hi, Steve Ornett, North Carolina, longtime listener to the MacCast. I was able to get my iPhone 5 on Friday after checking every day about 10 o'clock on the website to see what stock was available. Everything looks good, and I'm glad to have it. I just found out a very disturbing fact, though. I was going to plug it into my PowerPC Mac G5, and it said it won't work because I don't have 10.7 iTunes. Went to Apple Downloads, and it said 10.7 is only supported with Intel processors. This is something you've been talking about, and I'm very upset about this. This PowerPC is working fine. I've upgraded the memory and the hard drive. I have a 1.5 terabyte drive in it and maxed out the memory. It works fine. And there's no reason that I should not be able to plug my iPhone into this. Thanks. Let me know what we can do to request Apple to add the PowerPC support to iTunes 10.7 or to 10.6 XYZ or whatever version. Thanks. I appreciate you and all the things you've done for the Mac community. Keep up the great work. And I'll see you all later.
Hey, Steve, you know, I really wish I had a really good answer for you on this one. And unfortunately, beyond upgrading to an Intel-based Mac, I really don't think I do. I certainly share your frustrations, which is why I wanted to actually share your message. But I think at this point, Apple has put the writing on the wall, or the writing on the tech support page, as it were, within the technical specifications. And they're saying if you want to use their latest devices like the iPhone 5, you are going to have to upgrade your Mac hardware to the latest Intel systems. You know, I had to go back and look and see when the last PowerPC Power Mac G5 was made using my trusty Mac tracker. And went back, it was made in August of 2006. So I guess after about 6 years, Apple is saying or forcing us or telling us we have to move on. And unfortunately, I think guys like you and I tend to not necessarily agree with them because, I mean, these systems after 6 years, as you're pointing out, for many people are very viable and usable and trusty and great systems that continue to work. And they're, when you think about it, iTunes and iOS devices, there shouldn't be any kind of technical limitation why Apple couldn't make them work. I do think it's somewhat of a resources situation, though, where, you know, they have to move on and they can't perpetually continue to support the older hardware and technology with new versions of, say, iTunes and things like that. So this is really an iTunes software issue and getting it to work with PowerPC. And while it's frustrating and annoying, I think it's sadly the state of how technology works these days. You know, stuff moves really quickly and companies move on quickly and they kind of keep pushing the ball forward. And unfortunately, some of us get caught in the wake and we end up in the kinds of situations that you and I find ourselves in where we have great hardware that we absolutely love and want to continue to use. But we also like the newest, latest and greatest stuff. And it may not always be compatible. So as far as what we could do to get Apple to change it, you could try submitting a request to apple.com/feedback, or you could even, you know, email Tim Cook at tcook@apple.com, which is actually, for this kind of thing, probably your best bet. Just, you know, explain, hey, we like this hardware. We love this stuff. You guys make such great products. It really lasts and they have longevity. You might consider extending the support for this sort of stuff to sort of meet the quality of the hardware and the software that Apple puts together. But my guess is that you're not ever going to get iPhone 5 support with older PowerPC systems, even if, you know, a million of us were to complain about it. It's probably just not going to happen. I think Apple's kind of moved on at this point. Yeah, sad but true, but there you have it. So on that somewhat sad note, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you all, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile Software, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, Text Expander Touch, PDF Pen for iPad, and now PDF Pen for iPhone. You can get more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, if you want to get cash for your old Apple gear, your iPhones, your iPods, even your Mac laptops, get a free quote and more information over at gazelle.com. And Citrix, check out GoToMeeting with HD Faces. You can get a free trial for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com and be sure to enter the code MACCAST. And big thank you to all of my show sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Also, big thank you to you for your support. If you have feedback for me, you can send emails and comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline, leave voicemail. That's at 281-622-4269. 281-MAC-IAM-9 is the phone number. If you are out of the country and want to save on long distance charges, you can use Skype. My Skype address is the MACCAST, and there's voicemail there as well. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you'll find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at MACCAST over there. And be sure to check out the MACCAST Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/TheMACCAST. So that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.